All right, so today we are diving right back into the story of Abraham in the book of Genesis, the series called to cross over, which actually we'll be finishing up in the next, I want to say, 3 or 4 weeks. So I hope you've enjoyed the journey and that you continue to enjoy the journey through Abraham's life again this morning. This message that I'm going to share with you is really the first of two parts, because we are going to look in Genesis chapter 22 at what many Bible scholars believe is the pinnacle of the Abraham narrative. It is the climax of the Abrahamic story in Genesis chapter 22. And because it's so loaded with imagery and conversation and what we can gather from it, we're going to do it in two parts. So this morning is part one. And we're going to see how, having recently received the fulfillment of God's promised son in the form of Isaac, Abraham will now be put to the test, hence the title of the message, Put to the Test. The story in Genesis 22 has a lot to teach us both about Abraham and his faith and about God, and we'll get to a lot of what it teaches us about God next week. For now, we're going to look at Abraham and his life and what we can glean from him as he has to struggle through what proves to be a very challenging test. I have to apologize right up front. If I cough, I'll do my best to turn away from the mic that follows my face wherever I go. This is the home stretch. My voice started to get weak yesterday, and now we're at the end of two services and all the singing and the preaching once. So just said, God, get me through the end of second service and we'll be good to go. So if you want to follow along, we'll be in Genesis. There we go. Chapter 22. I'm just reading the first five verses today. Sometime later, God tested Abraham and he said to him, Abraham, here I am, he replied. Then God said, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son, Isaac. And when he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. And on the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. And he said to his servants, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you. So as you can see, Abraham is going to be put to an enormous test involving his beloved son, Isaac. You know, testing is something that's become more and more of a normal part of our world, of our culture. It seems that you need to take tests to prove that you can receive employment. You need to continue to take tests to prove that you should stay employed. You need to take tests for this thing, that thing, and the other. Probably the biggest place where testing has become something that has just exploded in the last half century is actually within our schools. There are tests for every single thing you can imagine, and then there are tests on top of that. Not just in-class tests, but there are also these standardized tests that keep popping up everywhere to prove that our students or our teachers or our schools are doing exactly what they need to be doing. And what's happened in that same amount of time is scientists have started to study a new phenomenon. It's called test anxiety. Because we're so bombarded with testing, we have a thing now called test anxiety, a very real thing. Here's the definition that I found online this week. Test anxiety is a combination of tension, worry, dread, fear of failure, catastrophizing, extreme stress, anxiety, discomfort that come along during or before even taking a test. So not just little, oh, I'm kind of nervous or did I study enough. This is like really, really big, like huge anxiety, like eyes popping out of your skull because you're so uncomfortable, you're so anxious, you fear failing so deeply. I love the term catastrophizing. You know, that this will be a catastrophe if I don't pass or if I don't merely do as well as I think I should do. It's a real thing that is tied to even academic performance. Studies show that that students who have test anxiety like this, they actually score 12 percentage points lower than their non-anxious partners in fellow students. And it not only affects tests, but even dropout rates, because the more anxious you get over tests, and if you don't do well, the anxiety builds, and it affects dropout rates, it affects how students are socially and emotionally and even behaviorally and developmentally, it affects a ton of things. And you might think that it's a somewhat rare thing to have this level of anxiety, but if you wanted to take a guess mentally, how many students, what percentage of students would you say are studied and come out with this sort of test anxiety? Because the answer is somewhere between 25 and 40% of our kids and our teenagers suffer from this level of anxiety with testing. And something I found quite interesting is that it's most apparent in two different sort of subsets, students with disabilities and students who are in gifted classrooms. Because students with disabilities probably believing, you know, I'll never be good enough, and students in gifted classrooms thinking if I'm not absolutely perfect, right? So it's a very real thing. Now, I have to say that I never can remember struggling with any sort of paper pencil in the classroom test anxiety, but there was a time that I did experience what I think was close to test anxiety, and I actually shared it. This is funny. I was cleaning out the desk in our basement, just within the last couple days, and I found some doodle notes that somebody had taken during a sermon I preached over 5 years ago on Father's Day in 2012 on this passage. And one of the things I was reminded of in reading those notes is that I talked about my test anxiety not with paper pencil in the classroom, but with driving, right? I was 16 years old, right? 16 years old, and I was deciding to take my driver's test, and I failed the maneuverability portion of my driver's test not once, but two times. And I knew I was at risk that if I failed again a third time, I'd read somewhere that they would probably likely not let me test again for 6 months. And as a 16-year-old waiting to get his license, if you tell me I might have to wait 6 more months, you might as well say 8 years. 6 more months is an eternity. And I remember lying awake on the verge of tears thinking, if I don't get this figured out, I don't know that my life will ever move forward, right? It was a real thing. And so my solution, my friend, one of my best friends at the time, it would have been the mid-90s I was taking these driver's tests, and one of my best friends, he'd already passed this, and he was driving around, if you remember the make and model, a mid-80s Dodge Omni. It was the kind of car he had. It's probably about this big. And I realized, if I can't pass my maneuverability test in a Dodge Omni, maybe I don't deserve to be on the road with other human beings in their cars, right? So I did. I took the test, and it's fine. And I have to say, as a testament, I don't want to brag, but I need to find wood to knock on. Like, I've never been in a major accident. I've never even gotten a ticket. Yeah, right here, my stool. So, you know, no ticket. I've only been pulled over once because I ran a stoplight that was orangish when I went through the intersection, right? But it got me thinking that if we can have test anxiety from adverbs and states and capitals and equations, if I can have test anxiety based on 5 orange cones and a guy with a clipboard sitting next to me, can you imagine the anxiety that Abraham goes through when God puts him to this test? I can't even imagine it. It's a test that I'd like to think I would pass if I were in Abraham's shoes, but as I tuck my children into bed at night, I think, please God, please don't put me to that sort of test, because I don't really know how it would come out. The Hebrew word that gets translated, what we read today, as tested, is sometimes understood and even still translated in some places as tempted instead of tested in some versions of the Bible, that God is tempting Abraham. So I want to start off by saying, please do not misunderstand the difference between tempting and testing. Okay, God is not tempting Abraham in this situation. And how do we know that? Because Scripture is abundantly clear in multiple places that God does not tempt us. God does not want to draw us anywhere near to temptation. He doesn't want us to make decisions that lead to sin, that lead to destruction in our own lives, our lives in relationship with Him and with other people. God does not tempt us. For evidence, James chapter 1, verse 13, listen to these words. When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does He tempt anyone. For further evidence, 1 John chapter 2, 16, for everything in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, comes not from the Father, but from where? From the world, right? So when we are tempted in this life, do not say, God is tempting me. When we are tempted, it is by outside evil spiritual forces in this world, and it is by our own flesh that tells us, oh, I have to have that, I need that, I must get that, whatever that is. God does not tempt His people. But, according to this passage, God does test his people. But he only will do it for the purpose of either confirming or building up our faith, is what we learn from Scripture. Does God tempt us? No, never. Does God test us? Yes, sometimes, but only because he wants to confirm or to build up the faith that we have. And I want to pause really quickly and make sure we all understand this crucial thing. Please do not widen the definition of what it looks like when God tests people, because there is the temptation that whenever bad things happen, that we say, well, God must be testing me. Listen, Abraham had a choice. That's the test. God said, this is your choice to do these things. Abraham could have said no. So when you receive a scary medical diagnosis, when you lose your job, when you are in an accident, like don't say, oh, God must be testing me, because you don't choose those things, right? So let's not widen this up and make every bit of suffering, every tragedy about God testing us. But in this instance, he is testing Abraham. We know that God only tests us to confirm or build our faith because of other passages of Scripture. Genesis chapter 20, verse 20, Moses is speaking to the people and he says, do not be afraid. God has come to test you so that the fear of God will be with you to keep you from sinning. If you know Exodus chapter 20, you know that this is right after the receiving of the Ten Commandments, the famous top 10, and Mount Sinai is just shaking, right? And there's smoke and there's fire and the people are understandably afraid, and Moses says, listen, don't be afraid. God has come and God is testing you, but why is he testing you? To keep you from sinning. I would put it like this. Testing can help give us victory over later tempting. Sometimes God tests us in order that later on when we are tempted by other things that are not God, that we can have victory over those temptations. So sometimes God does the testing in order to keep us when temptation comes along. Or how about this one from Deuteronomy chapter 8? This is after the time in the desert and the wandering. Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the wilderness for 40 years to humble and test you in order to know what was in your heart. So testing reveals what's in our hearts. It's a way to help to avoid temptation later, but it's also a revelation. And by the way, God does not tempt you in order to reveal to him what's in your heart. He knows what's in your heart. But the testing, I think, helps us understand what's the condition of our hearts. So does God ever tempt us? Absolutely not. But God sometimes might test us, but he will only do so to strengthen or confirm our faith, to help us avoid future temptation, or to reveal, to show us what's truly in our hearts. Because listen, you can proclaim a lot with your mouth about faith and obedience and things like that, but your heart is infinitely more true than your mouth will ever be. And testing kind of brings that to the surface sometimes. So what does Abraham's test look like? It must have been much harder than anything Abraham had experienced yet. And don't forget, he's experienced a lot. I mean, the initial call to leave family and homeland to go to the place that God says, I'll tell you when you get there. You know, he experienced the episode in Egypt. He's experienced the circumcision. He's experienced going to battle to rescue Lot. He has lots of experiences, and yet I have to believe this one takes the cake. Like, this experience is bigger than all of those other experiences. It's what I would call a test for whether or not Abraham has God and thinking, is the way I would phrase it. Did you notice the emphasis in the text on Isaac? Take your son, comma, your only son, comma, whom you love, Isaac. I mean, such emphasis in the text to drive home how difficult this would have been. And now Isaac is much more grown, but you can picture Abraham holding that baby, that son, that only son, that beloved son. I mean, there's no doubt as we read this passage that Abraham can say, I need to sacrifice a son. Hang on. Ishmael couldn't have gotten too far away. We'll go into the wilderness. We'll find him, and we'll bring him back, and we'll do this thing with him. No, it has to be your son, your only son, your beloved son. It has to be Isaac. And also, there's no doubt that for Abraham, he does not look upon Isaac as some sort of cold commodity. And let's be honest with ourselves, with each other. In Abraham's day and time, children were much more practical than we view them today. And some people would view them as commodities, people that help you farm and things like, but not Abraham. This is not a commodity. This is his son, his only son, his beloved son. That's the one. That's what the test is about. We don't know exactly how old Isaac is at this point in time, but based on contextual clues and what we understand about what's going on in the text, most scholars believe by this point in time that Isaac is at least a teenager, if not a young man. So if you see pictures of this scene happening in Exodus 22, and Isaac's like this four-year-old skipping along with dad, like probably not the best picture of what was happening, which plays a whole nother level. We'll get to that next week. But So you have Isaac as an adolescent, a teenager, maybe even a young man. We know this because later on he'll carry an entire load of wood for an offering, right? He'll talk to his dad as an adult, not as a child. And there's also a little bit of imagery going on with a comparison to Ishmael when he was sent away and expelled. So all of that leads us to believe those things about Isaac's age. But isn't it easy to imagine that Abraham looks at Isaac with this God and mentality? He looks at this son of promise, and he says, I have God and I have Isaac. Now, it still happens today, right? Because children change people. Look, when my children were born and I held them and I looked at them, it's like, I would give anything for this child, right? And it can be easy to fall into God and my child, right? And I'll tell you what, if having a child changes people, having grandchildren makes people into people they were never before, right? And you laugh because you know it's true, right? Like, you look at people who maybe parented you, and then you watch them parent your kids, and you're like, who are you? Where did you come from, right? The running joke is that grandma and grandpa's house is kind of like Vegas. What happens there stays there, right? Children change people, grandchildren change people. We look at those children and grandchildren and we go, I would do literally anything, which is strong and it's powerful and it's good, right? And think about Abraham on top of just this. He's lost Lot. I mean, we don't think that he has contact with Lot after he sees Sodom from a distance. So he's lost Lot to Sodom. He's lost Ishmael to the wilderness. And now God is saying you need to lose Isaac as a sacrifice. I can't imagine what must have been going through his mind as he received this message from God. What do I mean by a God and mentality? Basically this, a God and mentality says, yes, I love God, but I also love ... fill in the blank. By the way, this is a common theme over and over again for God's people in the Old Testament, right? They wanted to follow Yahweh, but then they also ended up following these other gods, Baal and the Asherah poles and things like that. And what's really interesting, and keep this in mind, it's not that they, at least from their perspective, they ever reject God. They say, yeah, we're going to continue to worship Yahweh and continue to sacrifice to him, but we'll also have Baal. We'll also have these other gods just to kind of cover our bases because they seem like valuable commodities to have around, valuable gods to have on our side. Throughout the Old Testament, it's God and you see the prophets constantly saying, no, come away from your idols. Come back to only me. And when this mentality exists, whether it's for the people of the Old Testament or for us today, we have to ask this question, will we be obediently content with God and God alone? That is the question that must be asked. Will we be obediently content with God and God alone? And by the way, if you want an extended look at this question, read the book of Job this week. That's pretty much it. Will we be content, obediently content with God and God alone? And listen, I know what you're thinking, because I thought the same thing as I'm writing these notes up. Like, I love my wife, I love my kids, I love my sports teams. I love my ability to provide financially for my family and to plan for the future. I love my comfort. I love my homeland, I love my job, I love my hobbies. And the question is though, if I lost all of those things, could I still be obediently content with Jesus alone? Not that I wouldn't mourn those things if I lost them, because I would, rightfully so. I mean, when your favorite sports team loses a game, you mourn just a little bit. If you follow the Indians, it's only once every 6 weeks or so at this point that you have to mourn that. But you mourn a little bit, right? When you mourn, when you lose the ability to do the things, the hobbies that you love, for whatever reason, age, circumstances, you mourn because you can't do the things you used to do. When you lose someone, whether it's a spouse or a father, a mother, a child, a grandchild, you mourn deeply, and you need to. But on the other side of the mourning and the grief, can you maintain a contentedness in God and God alone? That's what Abraham is having to go through. And one more thing about Abraham's perspective that I think we have to remember is a little different than ours. When we read this passage, it absolutely shocks our senses. What? That God would call for Abraham to sacrifice not only a child in general, but his only, his beloved, and we are just shocked to the core. But you have to remember, in Abraham's time, in Abraham's culture, he's still being called by God to understand this crossing over. What does it mean to follow this God instead of the other gods that have surrounded Abraham his entire life? Okay, he may not have been as shocked as we are today, because in Abraham's day, this is how religion worked. This is what God or the gods expected of you. You can read in the Old Testament about Moloch and all these others. They required you to sacrifice that which was most valuable to you, including your children, in order to appease them. So Abraham may not have been as shocked as we are today. And put a pin in that, because we will definitely get back to that next week. But Abraham responds with preparations and with a journey. We're told that he left early in the morning, and isn't that interesting? It's a way of the text telling us that his obedience was immediate. There was no questioning. He left early in the morning. However, even though he left early in the morning, if you look at the decisions he made in that morning time, they are decisions that look like someone who's either not thinking clearly or is trying to avoid reaching the end of a to-do list. So here's what we mean. Getting up early in the morning, that's, you know, Abraham's faithfulness, right, on display. But then what does he do in the morning? We're told that the first thing he does is load the donkey first. Then he gathers the servants and Isaac, and then he cuts the wood. Now, any right-thinking person would say, I should probably cut the wood before I start to saddle the donkey, because that's the natural order of things. So at the very least, I think we could say that Abraham had some conflicted emotions that morning, as we might imagine, or I might even go as far as to say Abraham is doing things in such a way that he is drawing out the inevitable as far as he possibly can. And I think the biggest evidence for that is that we're told that when Abraham finished cutting the wood, they left. Think about this for a second. Approximately how old is Abraham right now? Give or take, we're talking a guy who's probably pushing 120 years old, right? If you want the wood cut as quickly as humanly possible to get on the road, this is where you say to your youngest and spryest servants, hey, cut me some wood. But if you want to draw it out as long as you possibly can, hoping against hope that God speaks again and says, Abraham, yes, I'm listening, forget the whole Isaac thing. We'll do something else. Then as a 120-year-old man, you do that yourself. I've only cut wood a few times in my life, but that is a monstrously physical activity for a youngish man in decent shape. I can't imagine a 120-year-old man getting the wood ready, drawing things out, hoping maybe I won't ever get to the end of this to-do list and face what lies ahead of me. This mixture of obedience, leaving early in the morning, but then this acting strangely, it's really the story of Abraham's life up until this point, mostly faithful with some speed bumps along the way. Reminds me of a title of a book. I love the phrase in this title. Eugene Peterson wrote a book called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction, with the subtitle of Discipleship in an Instant Society. What a great title and subtitle. And here's, just for fun, here's the really great irony about this. He wrote this book in the year 2000. Do you think our world has gotten more instant in the last 17 years? Absolutely. Absolutely. But I love that phrase, a long obedience in the same direction. I think many times as Christians, we think about how we're going to be obedient with the next big thing or the next thing way down on the horizon instead of focusing on a long obedience that starts now and simply moves in the same direction. I think with Abraham, this was his thinking. How else do you get through the preparation and a three-day journey with this son except by thinking this is this obedience in a long direction? That three-day journey from Beersheba, where he is, to Moriah, which we believe to be somewhere in or around Jerusalem, which we'll get to that next week, right? So about 48 miles. So 15-ish miles a day for a guy who's 120. That's enough, right? But just imagine the pain in every step. Think that he's getting closer and closer to having to do this thing God called him to do. Makes me ask this question that I want to ask of you today. Can we, especially during times of testing, can we just focus on being faithful and obedient with the very next thing in front of us? Not getting distracted about how am I going to be obedient and faithful with this thing that's coming later, this next big thing that's on the horizon. How can I practice a long obedience in the same direction starting right now and just putting the next foot in front of the other? I have to believe that's the only way Abraham made that journey. It's by thinking, I just need to put one foot obedience in front of the other, a step at a time. And they finally arrive at the foot of the mountain. And today we stop the text at a particular point. Because Abraham tells his servants, hey, you guys stay here at the foot of the mountain with the donkey, and then Isaac and I are going to go worship. And then he says something really strange. After we're done worshiping, we will come back to you. What? We will come back to you? We as in the plural form, we as in more than one person is going to come back from this worship experience? Interesting. There's about three possible explanations for why Abraham says what he says and what he means. The first one is simple. It's just a little teeny tiny itty bitty white lie that he tells the servants to let them continue to believe everything's fine, everything's normal, you stay here, we'll go and offer a sacrifice on an altar and we'll come back. Because if he tells them the plan, I mean, these are servants that probably have grown up with Isaac. They may try and stop the whole thing. So maybe it's just a little white lie that he tells the servants. I mean, one of the other possibilities is that it's not a white lie so much as we are seeing the weakening of Abraham's resolve. Maybe Abraham believes, listen, we're going to go and worship, but I don't have the heart to do it. And so it'll end up being both of us that come back because I could never do this thing. But I believe there's an explanation that is actually far better than either of those two. And it's that Abraham is a man at this point in life, in this moment, of audacious hope. Risky hope. Right? I think it's a statement of audacious hope. It's a statement from someone who has a hope that's rooted more deeply in God's promises than in his own understanding of what's going on. I think Abraham looks back and he looks back to that first promise of God to bless him and to make him into a great nation through his descendants. And God has confirmed that promise again and again and again. And I feel like Abraham's finally gotten to the place where he says, I don't know what's going to happen, but I trust in the promises of this God more than I trust in my ability to understand what's happening in this particular moment. It's a hope that says, listen, if God can bring new life from a couple who's as good as dead, remember that? If God can bring life from a couple who's as good as dead, then certainly God can somehow intervene in this situation as well. And the biggest reason I think this is what is the heart of what Abraham is saying is because we find this written in Hebrews chapter 11, that faith hall of fame. Listen to these words. By faith, Abraham, when tested by God, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, it's through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead. If that just doesn't get your heart exploding with hope, I'd have nothing else for you today. that Abraham was a man of such audacious hope that he believed, I will walk up this mountain with my son and I will do what God has called me to do, believing that even if I have to go through with giving my son as a burnt offering, that God may just be able to bring life back from the grave. Does it sound familiar, my friends? Because it should. So a few questions for us to consider today as we finish up. What has a recent test revealed about your heart? Or maybe if God is testing you now, ask for the strength and the perseverance that you need, but also ask that your heart would be formed and purified in the process, that it would be revealed to you, your faith, that God would strengthen and build up your faith in the midst of the testing. Secondly, is there anything in your life that you could not stand to lose? Are you maybe a victim to that God and mentality? Is your contentment dependent on anything other than Christ? Again, not that anything, all those other things, they're not bad, but is your contentment based on anything other than Jesus? And lastly, take a moment today as we have this silent reflection to pray for someone that you know who's struggling through a test right now. Ask God to fill that person with audacious resurrection hope, that as dark as things may seem, that God is faithful in even the darkest circumstances. So take a moment now, if you want to pray, close your eyes, bow your head, just read through the words, allow the Spirit to speak to your heart today, and in just a moment or two, I'm going to close us with prayer.